As you can see, we're picking up our studies in the life of David this evening. And I particularly asked Ben to read through from the end of 1 Samuel into the beginning of 2 Samuel, because for those of you that might not be too familiar with this part of the Bible, this movement from the first book of Samuel into the second marks a very significant marker post in Old Testament history. Because as we saw in the reading from 1 Samuel 31, King Saul, at the end of 1 Samuel, dies. David, of course, is the man who has been anointed previously by Samuel to be the next king of Israel. And in the second chapter of 2 Samuel, David indeed receives that formal recognition as being the next king of Judah. And so it's a very significant marker post in the Old Testament as we move from these from one book of Samuel into the next. We're going to think a little bit this evening about King Saul, and then just a little from in comparison about David, and then we'll be returning to the opening chapters of 2 Samuel in the next couple of weeks. I want to begin with a question. I wonder if someone asked you to try and summarize your life in just two words, what words would you use to describe yourself and your life? If someone was describing you, what two words, they're only allowed to use two words, what two words might they choose to describe you? There's your headstone after you've left this world. And there is the memorial to you, inscribed in just two words. What two words would you use? What two words might someone else use of you? The reason I'm asking you that is because the Christian writer Arthur Pink uses two words to describe and summarize the life of King Saul. They are shattering words. Here's the words Arthur Pink uses to describe King Saul: godless incompetence. Now imagine that. Imagine walking through a cemetery and you're having a little look. Some people actually do this a lot, you know. I don't. Some do. They're walking through a graveyard reading the gravestones and they come across, there's the name. And there's just two words: godless incompetence. What a thing to say about someone. Is Arthur Pink correct in his summary of Saul's life? And if he is, what a shattering thing to have said about you. Well, a little later, I want to consider two alternative words that can be said of David. And we can see that as believers, we have great hope because of God's grace. But Arthur Pink summarizes King Saul as being all about godless incompetence. What a dreadful summation of a man's life. And it's interesting, isn't it, that someone should end up concluding that that is all that a man has to show for his life, because the story of King Saul starts out so well. The story of King Saul begins with so much promise. It seems as though this is really going to be a wonderful period of Israel's history that they're entering into. It seems as if it's going to be marvelous. But of course, we do need to remember the circumstances that surrounded Saul's being appointed and anointed as the king. it all goes back to chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, where we find, as some of you will know, the nation of Israel were looking around at all the other pagan nations and seeing that each one of them has a king. And Israel had never had a king. They've had prophets. They've had judges. They've had priests. But they've never had a king. Well, at least that's how it seems to them. Of course, the reality is that God has been to them their king. And that's part of God's kingly function over his nation of Israel. But they've lost sight of that fact, and they've just looked at what all the other nations have got and decided we want the same as them. And in 1 Samuel 8, let me read you a couple of the verses. Give us a king, 1 Samuel 8 verse 6. Give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. He was a godly man. He took it straight to the Lord in prayer. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you. Because, of course, Samuel was God's spokesman. But they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. They want someone else to reign over them, not God. And then in verse 18, you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us. You see, Samuel had warned them that this is a poor choice you're making. This is not going to end well. And Samuel, on several occasions, gave this message to the people, but still they were insistent. No, we want to be like everybody else. We want a king. And that's how they came to have Saul as their first king. And in 1 Samuel 9 verse 2, we read this about Saul. Saul's father, who was a Benjamite, he had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Verse 17, so when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, there he is, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall reign over my people. Now it all seems to be starting so well. Here is this rugged, handsome young man, and he's tall, and he's everyone's image of a king. If you'd asked anyone, picture in your mind what you want your king to look like, and then they brought Saul in front of them, yes, they'd have said, that's exactly the man that we want. That's exactly the man we're looking for. Look at him. And of course, that was the problem. If they'd been casting for someone to play the role of Saul in a film, Saul would have played himself very nicely. Tall, dark, handsome, every bit the screen star. Hollywood would have lapped him up. But you see, you need a bit more depth to you than that if you're actually going to be the king over God's nation. But it's interesting that what's recorded for us in Scripture is just this guy's looks. The fact that he was head and shoulders literally above everybody else. Saul looked the part. And the thing about Saul is that he was everything that the ungodly desired. Everything about the man ticked all the boxes, as people might say. But there's an interesting verse in the book of Hosea. And this is widely regarded as to be speaking about Saul. It's Hosea chapter 13 and verse 11. Let me read from verse 9. O Israel, you are destroyed, but your help is from me. I will be your king. Where is any other that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges to whom you said, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath. God says in Hosea, I gave you that king in my anger. You persisted in asking, and I gave you what you asked for. The thing you were asking for was not the thing that was best for you. The thing that you were asking for was not something that in the long run would be good for you. And I warned you that it was not a good choice. I warned you that there was a better way, and still you persisted. So I gave you what you asked for. Isn't that amazing? And what an important lesson for us to bear in mind as Christian people. What an important thing it is to bear in mind what we ask for in prayer. But now we read in the Bible, don't we, that God gives us every good thing. And we might assume that if we pray for something and God gives it to us, then it, because God has apparently answered our prayer, then surely this must be a great thing that God has done. And yet in the Bible, we find an example of God giving people what they asked for, but he does it out of his anger. Because of their disobedience, he gives them what they've asked for. And it's not going to do them good. And so when we discover that the story of Saul starts off well, if we don't have that view that Hosea gives us, we can really come off on the wrong foot, can't we? Because to begin with, Saul seems to do really well as the king. And things really seem to be ticking along quite nicely. But an important lesson that the Bible teaches us is, well, it's okay starting well, but it's how you finish that's really important. Making a good start is one thing, but how are you going to finish? Do you remember the parable of the sower, the parable of the soils that Jesus told? And he told, didn't he, about the seed being sown, and it was the same seed that was being sown, but it fell on different types of soil. And the resulting growth that the seed had wasn't anything to do with the seed, it was to do with the soil. And some of the seed apparently grew and was doing okay. Some of it even came up out of the ground really fast. And some people looked at that bit of growth over there and said, look at that, that's really making progress. That's doing fantastically well. And yet the plants that were making superb growth in the early days actually still were some of those plants that died off. They didn't last the course. They'd started well, but they didn't finish. And this is a story in the Bible that shows us that starting well is one thing, but it's how we finish that's the important thing. When we give our testimony, it's brilliant to be able to look back at all the wonderful things that we've seen God doing in our lives in the past. But what is God doing in my life today? It's great to be able to look back and say, let me tell you about something that God did last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But can we stand and tell people about what God is doing in my life today? Let me tell you about the great things God has done for me today. Let me tell you about how I've walked with him today. Let me tell you about the communion that I've had with him today. Let me show you this verse in the Bible that I've read today, that has spoken to me today, that has directed and guided and helped me today. Let me tell you about something that the Lord is leading me into and directing me for. Let me tell you about something that's coming up, and it really is something that is going to be quite a trial for me. But my hope and my trust is in God. And I'm stepping forward because I know that I'm in his hand. And I know that he's mine and I'm his. And it's all about where I am today. And that was Saul's problem. Because as we read through Saul's life, we discover he didn't have a today when it came to his relationship with the Lord. It didn't exist. And within a few chapters of Saul being anointed as the king, God has rejected him. And unknown to Saul, he's already had Samuel anoint his successor. Saul started well in the eyes of everybody. He was their hero. Well, for most, there were some who rejected him. But how are we going to finish? We considered on Wednesday from Hebrews, didn't we? Keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus, who is the author and the finisher of our faith. We were reminded that the one who brings us to faith is the one who will see us to the end. But we need to keep our eyes fixed on him, looking unto Jesus. It's not just that one day in the past I looked. It's looking, continuous looking. Keep on looking. Keep on running the race. And we were reminded in Hebrews that it's not a race where we're competing against each other. It's a race that simply requires us to cross the finish line. That's what it's about. Saul wasn't in the race. He didn't cross the finish line. Started well. But he wasn't a godly man. And we've seen how his life has just unfolded and imploded. It says in the Bible that God's Spirit was upon him when he first became king. But you see, God is able to have his hand on every situation. God is able to put his hand on any person and use them for his purposes. It doesn't mean they're a child of God. It doesn't mean they're a believer. And God has used Saul. And we've been following how Saul has been after David. We've seen how David has gone into exile. We've seen how Saul's whole life has just been taken up with having to get rid of this man. The last time we were doing our study, we saw the very last conversation that David and Saul had. That was a couple of chapters ago, and that was the final face-to-face confrontation that the two men would have. That was the very last time that David would see Saul alive. And then we have this tragic end to Saul's life recorded at the end of 1 Samuel in chapter 31. And here they are in battle. And Saul, he's a godless man. He's become incompetent as a king. He hasn't been able to lead the nation. He hasn't been able to lead the people. They're battling against the Philistines. And it's all up for them. The Lord has abandoned them. The Lord in his anger had appointed Saul. He'd given the people what they wanted. And the Lord in his wrath is about to remove him. And there they are on the battlefield, and Saul can see that it's all up. And he can see that the Philistines are attacking and approaching. He can imagine some of the awful things that the Philistines are going to be prepared to do to him. Some of you will have seen on the news these last few days and watched and listened with astonishment at those English Marines mistreating that guy in Afghanistan. Now, it was a field of war. But they shouldn't have done what they did. But at least what they did quickly, compared to how the Philistines probably would have treated Saul if they got their hands on him. And Saul knows what they're likely to do to him. And he just wants out of it as quick as possible. And we might say, well, who can blame the guy? And he asks his armor bearer to finish him off. In verse 4, he's already been injured, and his armor bearer just don't do it. And so Saul puts his sword in the ground and falls on his own sword and kills himself. And that's a sign of the man, that he would come to such a state, that he would take his own life in that way. It all started so well. What a dreadful end. It reminds us as Christians, when we think back to how the Israelites first appointed him, what they looked at, what they saw in him, it reminds us to be careful not to think like the world. It reminds us to be careful not to use the things that the world values. It reminds us not to count as worthy things that the world counts as worthy. If the Israelites, after they'd first anointed Saul as their king, had marched around with him at the front of their army, I'm sure all the surrounding nations would have been really impressed with this young man. Oh, now there's the kind of guy you want to be a king. Here's something for us to think about. Here's something for us to be worried about. Look at the guy that they've made king. And when we have things as Christians that impress the world, I think we need to realize that that will often strike a note of caution. If we've allowed to ourselves to be impressed by the things that impress the world, there's often the need for the note of caution. And it's left Israel in a terrible mess. And Arthur Pink looks at Saul's life and comes up with this far from flattering summation of his life: godless incompetence. And yet David, by contrast, at the beginning of 2 Samuel, shows the real heart of a godly man. Now, as we've seen, David's had all kinds of problems. He's had all kinds of issues. He's shown at times that he struggles with his faith. He's shown at times that he struggles to trust in the Lord as he should, at the same time as having these wonderful periods of amazing faith in the Lord. But he's struggled. But the thing we need to remember is it's not how you start. It's about continuing. And the thing that we see about David is that he continues. And he continues. And when he's confronted with his sin, he's repentant. And he returns to the Lord and he knows God's grace again. And he continues. And even though he's really going to fall from grace in the chapters that are yet to come to us, he has a repentant heart. And he receives God's grace even more. And he continues. And David, by comparison to Saul, despite having all kinds of problems and weaknesses, he will continue. Because it's not just about how you start. It's about the fact that you finish the race. And David is a man, even though he let God down in so many ways, under God's grace, he finished the race. And we see that compared to Saul's godless incompetence, in David there is godly integrity. Godly integrity. Now we're going to finish in a minute or two. I just want to point out a couple of verses that we read in 2 Samuel chapter 1. Because this man, this Amalekite, has arrived. David's been out doing his own thing. And he hasn't yet heard about what's happened to Saul and his men against the Philistines. And this young man comes on the scene. And some of you might have been thinking, as we read that through, hang on a minute, the story that this man tells is very different to what's recorded in 1 Samuel 31. The story that this young man gives bears no resemblance to what's recorded in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. What's going on here? Well, I think the thing is very simple. This young Amalekite comes to David and tells David what he thinks David wants to hear. He comes up with this story that he thinks is going to put himself in favor with David. This David, surely, is going to be made up to hear that Saul has died. And what better thing to actually let David think that I've been part of seeing Saul off? David's going to be made up with me. Well, if you don't know the story, we'll find out what happens to him next week and you can read it for yourself when you get home. It doesn't quite work out the way he imagined it would. But he comes to David with this story about Saul's death. And the response of David is remarkable when you think all that he's endured under Saul's hand. David tore his clothes. That's the ultimate sign of mourning. That's the ultimate sign of sorrow. David took his clothes and tore his clothes. They mourned, they wept and fasted for Saul and for Jonathan, for the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Here is David mourning and weeping over the death of Saul. How can you do that? Is that not a mark of godly grace in David's life? Some of you will recall the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, where in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says this: "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven." And I guess that when we read words like that, we tend to think, well, God's just exaggerating to make a point. He doesn't really mean that we're to love our enemies. He doesn't really mean that we're to bless them, does he? And yet in Proverbs chapter 24 and verse 17, we read this: "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him." And here is the true sign of David's godly integrity. Here is the sign of God's grace in the life of this man. That even though God has brought this terrible suffering into his life, and even though God has brought this great injustice upon him for him to bear, David's done nothing wrong. He's done nothing to deserve Saul's anger and Saul's hatred. And yet here he is, mourning the death of his enemy. What is it that makes the difference? What is it that makes a man be able to behave like David did? What is it that marks him out against a man like Saul? It's the love and the grace of God. Excuse me a second. And by God's grace, my voice has just managed to last to the end. It's the love and grace of God that does that in the life of a man. It's the love and the grace of God that will do that in you. It's the love and the grace of God that will do that in me. Where do we stand this evening? Is our life like Saul? Is just godless? Or do we truly know the grace and the power and the love of God in our lives? We can know it by simply coming to him with repentant hearts, trusting in Christ, laying hold of all that Christ has done for us. And he will give us this grace that we see in David that stands in such stark contrast to King Saul. A man who started well, but he didn't see it through. David, by contrast, oh, the problems he'll have. The sin that he will allow himself to embrace. But yet he will know God's grace over and over and over again, because he is the Lord's. And we have that same promise of unending and abounding grace if we will turn to the Lord and know him.